I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia, at thecommentary.ca. Tom Hawthorne joins me again. He's just published a new book, Play Ball, The Amazing Stories and Captivating Characters Who Have Made Baseball a Winning Ticket in Vancouver for Over 100 Years. It is a tough book to put down because Tom, with his ability to weave together great stories about colorful characters on and off the field, terrific archival photos, along with his skill at providing the reader with the historical and cultural context within which baseball he writes about take place, make for not just a beautiful book for the coffee table, but a splendid resource for the sports fan or a Vancouver history buff. With a foreword by Jim Robson, we get a sense of baseball's endurance in Vancouver, and this is all despite the popularity of lacrosse, the BC Lions, and then the Vancouver Canucks throughout the 20th century and now. The book also charts baseball's development, relationships with leagues higher up in the pecking order through to Major League Baseball. Also, we see Vancouver's own growth and development. I found particularly poignant Tom's recounting of various ballparks that once stood throughout Vancouver. And, of course, Nat Bailey Stadium, Capilano Stadium before that, plays a central role in the book. It's a ballpark that Tom loves, and a lot of people who've played here or visited here or live near just love. As Tom says, the book was commissioned by Jake Kerr and Jeff Mooney, the former owners of the Vancouver Canadiens, and it also chronicles how baseball has continued to play a major part as a brand in the community, and that's largely thanks to Kerr and Mooney and all their efforts, not just with the club and the relationship with the Toronto Blue Jays, but with the upgrading of the facilities at Nat Bailey Stadium. Tom Hawthorne is a Victoria-based journalist and author. He is a regular contributor to the Globe and Mail. He has written several acclaimed books, including Deadlines and The Year Canadians Lost Their Mind and Found Their Country, which he's appeared on this program with when they came out. The book is available at Nat Bailey Stadium, another good reason to go to a Canadiens game, as well as at the BC Sports Hall of Fame, where they do mail orders as well. We taped this interview earlier this week with Tom joining me from Victoria, BC. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Tom Hawthorne. Mr. Hawthorne, good morning.
Hey, Joseph.
How are you?
I'm good. It's good to hear from you. I have to confess that sometimes I think I write a book just so we get a chance to talk again.
You're very kind. Sure, you know, the other thing that I was thinking about is that I'm surely not the only fan of yours who said on hearing that about this book, you know, finally a Tom Hawthorne baseball book. I mean, it seems like a perfect fit.
It did, and let me tell you how it came about. Jake Kerr and Jeff Mooney, who were the owners of the Vancouver Canadiens, had owned the team for a number of years, and they had decided that they were going to sell. They were going to get out of the baseball business, and they wanted to leave a legacy project. And they wanted to do, Grant is a collector of photos and other materials about Vancouver baseball history, and so he contacted Echo Publishing, Echo Storytelling, which is a publishing house that puts together book projects. And the word got around that they should talk to me because I'm a guy that's written about baseball for a fairly long time in Vancouver. And so we had a meeting and with the clients and the book people and myself. And one of the things I said is that I've spent my adult life with somebody who thinks baseball is okay, but it's entirely long by six innings. So that was the idea. How can we do a book about history of baseball in Vancouver and both satisfy the diehard fan like myself and how to satisfy people that may have a passing interest or have gone to Nat Bailey or have always meant to go? And so I think we've managed to do that. It's a fun book.
Yeah, it's a fun book, but what makes the book tough to put down are these stories. And as you write in the book, I mean, they're a great access point to this sport, the stories of the game beyond, say, the stats. You really learn about the people in such a unique way when it's around baseball, don't you?
You do, and I appreciate you saying that, Joseph, and noticing that in the book. It's, you know, my general, I love baseball, and I have since a boy. I had the great fortune to live in Montreal when the, be a nine-year-old boy when the Montreal Expos started in 1969. It was as if it was for me and my classmates, this new major league team. But I like stats, and I like some of the new stats that are in the common realm. But I'm always been more interested in the anecdotes, the personalities, who plays baseball, who got to play baseball, why were they in baseball, what did it mean to them, what did it mean to fail, what did it mean to succeed. And so for many years I've been collecting anecdotes and bits and pieces about the baseball history. And even one of them, there's one that's a completely unknown amateur player from 1900. There's an exhibit, you know, just a game happening in Vancouver, and the other batter hits a tall pop up, and the fielder gets underneath it and declares in a loud voice so the people in the stands can hear, "Ball, thou art mine," and then proceeded to drop the ball.
Yeah.
So this was in all three of the Vancouver Daily newspapers mocking this player for having said in a very pollutant language, "Ball, thou art mine." So just things like that that I've been kind of putting together for many, many, many years.
There's a great story in the book. It's almost there as an aside, but I found it particularly poignant. Before I mention it, like, I bought tickets to Nat Bailey for the Canadians, and I always make sure I sit behind that net because I don't want to get, you know, hit in the head by a ball or something like that, right?
Yeah.
And the story in the book is about the netting. It's made of gossamer, is that right?
Yeah. Well, it's the kind of regular, you know, it's whatever nets are made out of. It's pretty standard, but it's thin.
And I'm getting choked up thinking about it because the people who because every year they roll it up, I guess, and put it in storage for the longest time, because it was four fishers from Steveston that were in charge of, say, undoing that, because they knew that from their work from fishing, right?
Yeah.
A story like that, where do you find something like that?
Well, in that, I was working at the province in the sports department and essentially just doing feature stories. And I was at Nat Bailey one day and I saw the netting behind home plate, which is common in all the baseball parks. There's netting behind home plate. And happily, I have the same feeling as you, Joseph. It's important not to get hit by a batted ball because it hurts.
Yeah.
So they've now extended netting in all the parks everywhere, including the majors. But anyways, one day I'm there, and I just thought, who puts that netting up? Like, how do you do this? So I just asked around, and somebody at the park said, oh, yeah, those four old guys sitting at the back here in the grandstand, go talk to them. So I go up there, and indeed they were four fishermen from Steveston, all of Japanese Canadian heritage. And that was, they had played baseball as boys. Their families had been interned in 1942 and passed away from the coast, and they had come back afterwards and continued working as fishers. And they had this expertise of rolling and unrolling nets, and they would do that every year. And I think these four fellows did it together for over a quarter century.
Mm.
And in exchange, they just got a pass to the baseball park. And they did it. And it's just one of those little things that you could be, one of the things I like about baseball is that it's a slow game and can be boring and the mind can wander. And I was watching a ball game one day and just thought, who handles these nets? Yeah. I'm a guy that can't tie a knot in my softball cleats. I'm terrible with that. So I was quite filled with admiration for these four fellas.
Yeah, and you know, it comes at a point in the book where we've already read about the Asahi baseball team here in Vancouver, and the Asahi play such an important part in the history of the game in this town, don't they?
Absolutely. You know, in fact, I don't think you could understand the history of Vancouver as a city or Canada as a country without also dipping into the story of the Asahi. Vancouver was notoriously the scene of race riots in 1905. The Japanese community, which had warning because the white mob attacked the Chinese community first, they were able to defend themselves and defend their neighborhood with weapons. But at the same time, they realized that community also thought, well, we're here permanently. How can we express our communal pride? And they formed a baseball team called the Asahi around the time of the First World War. The First World War eased some tensions between white supremacists and Japanese Canadians in the sense that Japan was on the Allied side in the First World War. And so they formed this team, and over time that team became absolutely essential to the feelings that neighborhood had towards being Canadian and being Japanese Canadian. That team, I spoke to many younger people whose dads would work, these immigrant dads, working these incredibly tough jobs for no pay, enduring day-to-day racism in the city, on the streetcar, on the sidewalk. They would come after work and go to the Ball Diamond for the Asahi, which was what we know today as Oppenheimer Park, and at the time was called the Powell Street Grounds. Very modest little park, had wooden grandstand, about four or five rows, had chicken wire around home plate. People would, and you had to pay a modest admission to get in, a nickel or a dime. People would also stand behind the fence and to watch the game. But it was so essential to that community to cheer for this team. And in time, the team, because you know, the Asahi players were physically smaller than many of the other guys they were playing. Often longshoremen would be playing baseball, who were, you know, these big, burly, 6'2" guys in the 30s. And here are the Asahi, maybe 5'1", 5'2", 5'3", 130, 140 pounds, small and slight. And they developed a style of baseball that won them fans, even amongst the white community. So they played what was called brain ball. They would bunt to get on base. They would sacrifice to move the runner another base. They would steal a base. They couldn't rely on overpowering pitching, so they would often use change-ups and curves, things like that. But essentially, and one of the trademarks of the Asahi was their defense. And they had a star player named Roy Yamamura, the dancing shortstop, and he would teach young players coming up to, if they can't stop the ball with the glove, they had to use their chest, which is a pretty standard baseball thing, but hard to teach people if you've ever played, because that ball hurts. The last of the Asahi was a lovely man named Kei Kaminishi, who essentially was a backup for the Asahi in 1940, and lived to the ripe age of 102. He passed away a little over a year ago, and he was taught by Roy Yamamura, and so shared that insight about Roy's take on the game. And very ably, Kei very ably represented all his fallen teammates over the years in as the Asahi was, again, discovered and was part of a Heritage Minute by Historic Canada and a commemorative postage stamp by Canada Post. So it was really wonderful that Kei was still alive to take in all those honors.
You mentioned Oppenheimer Park. You know, that's the site now, the site then of a ballpark. Fifth and Hemlock were the Granville Bridge, I guess, where you enter off of. There used to be a ballpark there. I mean, you're quoting that Sinatra song. Homer and Smythe, Heather and 14th. I mean, I'll never go by these places again without thinking of what used to be there.
That's right. You know, and I'll tell you, Joseph, when I first moved to Vancouver in the late 70s, there was no baseball. It didn't come till pro baseball. It didn't come again to Vancouver to 1978. Again, just my great fortune. I moved to a new city. It does have a pro team, and then it does have a pro team. And I was curious. I'd heard about this, a team called the Vancouver Beavers and a team called the Vancouver Mounties, and where did all these teams play? And the Capilanos, where did they play? So the very first real ballpark was something called Recreation Park, which was at the corner of Homer and Smythe. People might, in their heads, imagine the Homer apartment block there, which is about three or four stories tall, beautiful old building. So that's roughly where home plate would have been, across the street. at the other part of Homer and Smythe. It went down towards the False Creek Water. The park didn't go that long, but you could see down the park because there were warehouses beyond the outfield and then False Creek beyond that. And it was quite a handsome little wooden stadium there, but it didn't last for too long. And then Bob Brown, who's the most important person in baseball in Vancouver history, had bought the team and built his own park at 5th and Hemlock. If you're driving westbound along the False Creek Road there, mm-hmm. and then you make that little jog underneath the on-ramp for the Granville Street Bridge, which is overhead just as you're coming by the entrance to
Granville Island.
Granville Island, you are actually driving through, first of all, the outfield and then the infield of the old ballpark. And that was where baseball, that was the heart of baseball for a very long time there. And that is where Babe Ruth played one day in the pouring rain in 1934. Lots of baseball history took place there. I wish there was a plaque. I don't believe there is. I wish there was an easier way to show where home plate was and where the stands were. It's very hard to stand there and today and see where things are. And I've seen every photo of that old ballpark. I've looked at maps of the old ballpark, mm-hmm. But it is too bad. And then the one that's on Heather Street was one I didn't know anything about. And research, again, it was there for a very short time. It was a failed attempt by a business person to launch a ball team and make some money. The Francophone School is there now, and where that school sits is essentially where home plate was. And at the time, it was seen as way outside the city because it was up around, I don't know, 14th or 16th, between, yeah, I think 14th and Heather.
Yeah.
But, you know, you could get there because the streetcar took you up to Broadway, so it was only a five-block walk uphill amongst the forest, and they put in a skid road, I guess, to make it easier. But, again, that was a failed ballpark.
There was a park too at where the old bus depot was. That's an empty parking lot now. That'll be the new art gallery, I suppose, right?
Yeah, that's right. And there was a fellow had a it was, you know, some baseball was played there, but it was better known for lacrosse and other events. And a fellow named Al Larwell had a cabin on that park, and essentially he was a squatter, but they let him stay there, and he essentially his very modest little cottage was also where the teams would keep their equipment. So it was kind of like a clubhouse almost on that spot. More often used as a parade ground and a gathering place for early Vancouver history.
Another great story that you tell in the book that I got chills as I was reading it was, you mentioned this park at 5th and Hemlock where Babe Ruth appeared. When they took that down, I understand, as you write in the book, that the grass was rolled up, and then they put that in what was then the new Capilano Stadium. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. In doing research for this, I was sad that this old ballpark had been reduced, and there's no history of it. Very typical Vancouver reaction to its history.
Sure.
But there was a photo in the Vancouver Sun archives, which the strips of the grass, of the infield grass at the old ballpark, were cut in long, narrow strips, and they're rolled up like jelly rolls. They look like green and white jelly rolls. And then they were transported to New Capilano Stadium, which we today know as Nat Bailey Stadium, and put in the infield. So essentially it was the very same grass that, you know, once the great Ruth had trod upon, was moved to the new park. Now, the new park and generations of changing grass and new infield grass and that, it's probably not the same connection, but it's not hard to imagine. If a Canadian's game gets a little dull and a little bored, I can't help myself but sit up there and imagine Ruth playing.
Yeah. Well, what is it about Nat Bailey Stadium that's so special for us? I mean, I guess I sort of take it for granted because I live so close to it. I heard Stephen Brunt on the radio the other day, and he mentioned you and talking about how It was his first time a few weeks ago going there, and he went there because of people like you telling him to go there. It's such a special place, and I know every chance you get, you try to get there, right?
I do, absolutely. Part of it is the scale of Nat Bailey. There's some beautiful major league ballparks, but they also seat 40,000 people, and they're massive and huge. Nat Bailey sits, you're talking 6,000 people centrally, so it's much more modest. I love it's where it's situated. Essentially, it's on former swamp land in the lee of Little Mountain there. Water would drain off the mountain in there, and it was completely undeveloped. Even in the post-war era, it was all kind of bush and unused, and nobody lived there. But when you sit in there now, you're looking out just beyond the outfield fence. There's Little Mountain, and it's greenery and trees, and we're sitting in this metropolis of million plus people, and you can forget it all if that's what you want to do. You can just gaze out on that greenery, on that beautiful greensward of the field, the outfield, the beautiful brown dirt of the infield, those precise white lines. You have a cold beer in your hand or a soda or a pop. You have a nice hot dog maybe, or there's better food choices these days. So there's just something where you are removed from the grind of day-to-day life. We're taking a 2.5 to 3 hour escape from the big city and from all our problems, and we're just being entertained by some very talented and athletic young men wearing very odd uniforms on this beautiful green field. It is really a special place, and it's so affordable. My feeling is if you're paying a movie ticket price to get into any entertainment the last 2.5 to 3 hours, you've got a good deal.
Indeed, yeah. I wondered about the mascot, Bob Brown Bear, at the Canadiens game, and I found it so fascinating to read in the book that he's named after the Bob Brown that you talk about in the book that you mentioned earlier, but how important he was to Vancouver and that they've taken his name and attached it to the mascot. I think it's kind of cool, you know?
Yeah, it was fun that they did the Bob Brown Bear. Bob Brown died in the early 60s. Mm. He'd been around for more than 50 years in baseball. He's pretty much forgotten now, which is what happens. But he was an American-born player. He played briefly in the minor leagues. He actually played football for Notre Dame, even though he wasn't a particularly big man. He served in the Spanish-American War, although he didn't see action. And he was trying to hustle a living as a pro ball player on the West Coast, and he co-owned a shoe store in Aberdeen, of all places, Aberdeen, Washington. But he came to Vancouver to play a game, and he thought, this city is going to take off. He had an understanding that with the railway ending in Vancouver and all these communities, Victoria and small Vancouver at the time, Seattle, that there was going to be a giant competition for which was going to be the metropolis, which was going to be the trade center of this region. And he bet his money on Vancouver. And he didn't have much money to bet it on. In fact, he did a little bit of hocus-pocus to get his hands on the team. He was coaching another team in the same league. He got like a $500 bonus for winning the championship that year. Used the $500 to leverage a promise of a bank loan that he didn't actually have from a bank, but he did get a note saying, oh, yes, we will front you this money. And then essentially the owners of the Vancouver team at the time were losing a lot of money, and they kind of just essentially wanted to get rid of the team. And Bob Brown got the team for not very much money for a song, and played for 2 years with somebody else owning the ballpark, which was this recreation park I talked about at Homer and Smythe. And then he decided he got his hands on some cheap CPR land at 5th and Hemlock on the other side of the Granville Street Bridge, and decided to build his own park, which he did himself. But the great, and again, this is Bob Brown, the business person. He got his, what he ended up doing is the person that owned Recreation Park, he bought the grandstands from them. And then, so when it was, when the people that owned the rest of that park were trying to put the screws to him on rent, he just said, forget it, I'm out of here. I've got my own ballpark that you don't know about that I'm just going to announce, and I've got even your grandstands. And that's how he operated. Now, Bob Brown did not make a fortune on baseball. He often had to pay out of his own pocket. He was known as quite a miserly owner, but he was a really good baseball man. He financed a team for the early years. He would hire up-and-coming young players cheap, give them an opportunity to play, and they would show how good they were, and then he would sell their rights, their contracts, to major league teams or higher teams in the minor leagues for a lot of money. And that's essentially how he kept baseball going for many, many years in Vancouver.
You know, I always wondered why they call it Nat Bailey Stadium, because I know Nat Bailey from White Spot. Right. But as I read in the book, I mean, he plays such an important part. I mean, if it weren't for him, there wouldn't be baseball in Vancouver for a period of time, right?
That's exactly right, Joseph. So Bob Brown gets old, and he's in, you know, he's in his 80s, and he's not really, he doesn't own anything anymore. He's not carrying it on. The team in 1956, the Mounties, they finally get a Triple-A team, one level below the majors. Uh-huh. The old Oakland Oaks moved up here for the 1956 season. Vancouver business people barely had enough money to keep it going, but Nat Bailey, who was the founder of the White Spot chain, who had actually got his start in food services by selling hot dogs at Bob Brown's old ballpark. That's how he got started in food service. This, you know, was kind of a driving force, selling, they sold shares in the team. They got business people to kick in $5,000 each to keep the team afloat. And it was really touch and go in Vancouver for pro baseball through the 60s. There were 2 years where the team just was gone, mm-hmm. But they managed to bring them back in time. And then by 1969, that was it. Baseball, pro baseball stopped in Vancouver. Then Harry Ornest, people may know, remember him from owning the St. Louis Blues of the NHL. Before he owned that hockey team, he was trying to get into owning sports franchises, and he got the rights to do a franchise in Vancouver. And they started play in 1978, and just before the season started, Nat Bailey passed away. And so I believe it was the park board, probably with the city council agreeing to name the park after Nat Bailey.
You mentioned the Oakland A's. The association with the A's and a team in Vancouver was up until very recently, up until Kerr and Mooney owned the team. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, it's the world of minor league baseball used to be much more complicated than it is now. So essentially you'd have all these minor league teams at various levels. At one point it was as low as D level, not in Vancouver, but D, C, B, A, double A, triple A, and then the majors. And each of these would be owned by a private business person. They would get players, they would hire some of their own players, or they would be paid by major league teams or high-level minor league teams to manage some players and all the rest. And so for the history of the Vancouver Canadiens, they've had different teams. They were a White Sox farm team for a while. Mm. They were Oakland A's for a very long time. The Mounties, who had preceded the Canadiens, they were a Kansas City A's, which was before the Oakland A's farm team, and a Baltimore Orioles farm team. And in 1969, they were actually a shared Seattle Pilots and Montreal Expos farm team, two of the saddest major league teams of all time. And so the cast-offs were here in Vancouver for that year, and then baseball stopped here. So, yeah, so it's a bit complicated, but you always are seeing. And then the big saving grace for the C's, for the Canadians, I think, was when they had an agreement with the Toronto Blue Jays to be one of their lowest level minor league teams. So the current Vancouver Canadians are what's called High A, is what it's called now. And they actually have two budding superstars for the Toronto Blue Jays on staff. Neither of whom I've seen in action. I would love to see the shortstop Arjun Nimala, who is lean and lanky, and you know, you think this kid can't hit home. Oh, he hit a home run. I think he's got 9 home runs so far this year. He's just fabulous to watch, very high prospect. And then a pitcher they just called up, Trey Yesavage. So I'm quite keen to see either of those. But, you know, many of the people you're seeing on TV every week playing for the Blue Jays, or now maybe they've moved on to other pro teams, they got their start in Vancouver. So yeah. It's a chance to see up-and-coming young athletes for a fairly affordable rate.
Yeah, I heard Nirmala interviewed on one of the sports talk shows recently, and they were talking about how the hosts were talking about how they're going to see him in Seattle one day when the Blue Jays are in town, and I found him just incredibly articulate. I don't know why I'm surprised that athletes will be articulate, but I found him particularly I found him just great to listen to.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, Joseph, the secret of sports writing when you're a sports writer is when one of those athletes is identified, you spend a lot of time with them. Because you're going to hear your share of cliches otherwise.
So this partnership with the Blue Jays, as you write about in the book, I mean, this is a, you know, the work of Jake Kerr and Jeff Mooney when they own the team. They do so much work in terms of upgrading the facility. PR, I mean, I can't think of a better brand in this province. I mean, it seems to do better than the hockey team in terms of how the public regard it. That's their work, isn't it?
Yes, it was. And, you know, they helped revive baseball here earlier in this century. You know, it's hard for me. I'm just 2025. you know, we're a quarter way through this century. So when they took over, I think the ballpark was very tired, very old-looking, and not really functioning well. It was under threat as the 2010 Olympics approached, and they were going to build facilities for the curling rinks.
Right.
Would the ballpark survive, and would the team survive? And, you know, Jake and Jeff were very keen on they understood, okay, we're going to have to spend some money here, and they did. And the ballpark, just to me, looks just fantastic. I didn't mind it when it was getting decrepit. There's a part, the writerly part of me likes a fall-down, sad ballpark where there's no running water and the players have to take cold showers, things like that. I don't think the players care for that kind of thing. But the investments were made in the Nat. The seating was slightly expanded. The food choices were far superior to what they had been.
Yeah.
It's just all around a much better experience. And as you know, again, as I mentioned earlier, the size of the park is great. It's not too big. It's easy to get in and out of. You know, I guess parking is probably a headache. It always has been at the Nat. But, you know, hop on Canada Line, which is how I get to the ballpark, or streetcar up Main Street, yep. Trolley bus up Main Street. It's a great place to walk to. And, you know, one of my favorite experiences always, no matter what city or where I'm going to a ball game, is that walking up to the park, that anticipation of 3 hours of leaving your troubles behind, of watching sports, of eating too much food, maybe drinking one more, drinking some beer or pop. I just love that feeling. So, and again, as I mentioned, I just love where Nat Bailey is situated. It's in a residential neighborhood next to a beautiful park, you know, very short walk from major thoroughfares, where you don't hear traffic in Nat Bailey. All you hear is the fans. You can actually hear the umpires' calls and people yelling insults from the stands and all of it. It's just such a wonderful place.
Yeah, I want to end with the Krieger brothers, because you mentioned them in the book. One's a cartoonist, and the other one was the president of the BCTF at one point. Both are great baseball fans. Which one pitched for the Mounties?
Yeah, so Kit Krieger was in 1968. He was 19 years old. He was attending UBC, and the Mounties, as I mentioned, were not very good team on the field. You know, they had lots of one of the oddities of the 1968 Mounties is they had on their roster, six of those players became major league managers, which is quite remarkable for any team, let alone a team that was bad.
Yeah.
so they including Tony La Russa was one of them. So they were a really bad team. Kit Krieger was the visiting clubhouse attendant. Mm-hmm. So essentially he cleaned the equipment, put out the equipment, put the beer in ice for the end of the game. He would be tipped by the players. They, you know, they would ask him questions about whatever bad things players get up to out of town when they're on the road and all that. And one of his duties was to pitch batting practice. Mm. And so so he asked the team if he could pitch the final game of the season on the promise that he would go out to campus and sell a bazillion tickets, and they'd actually have a sellout.
Yeah.
And the manager, Mickey Vernon, was unsure about this, but he was told that, you know, Kit would be, he wouldn't embarrass the team anyways. Like, who knows how he would do, but he wouldn't embarrass the team. So they let him. They let him pitch. They let the clubhouse boy pitch the last game of the season. So he gets out there. First of all, he didn't sell a bazillion tickets. You know, there was a reason nobody was going to the Mounties, and all the university students in 1968, they were totally uninterested. One of their own was going to pitch. So he goes out there last game of the season. He lasts three innings. He only gives up one earned run. He hits a batter. He strikes out a batter, a guy that almost never struck out. And then he's pulled before it's his turn to bat. He wears his cleats into the clubhouse to talk to the manager, and or not into the clubhouse, into the general office after he's done. So they immediately fine him $25 he was prorated to pay that day. So he makes no money at all. His brother Bob, who a lot of us would know as the province cartoonist for many, many years, really funny guy, great cartoonist. So he was filling in for his brother that day, but he was so keen on watching his brother pitch, he forgot to put the beer on ice. And then the game ended in a little over an hour, maybe even less than an hour. It was like the fastest game, one of the fastest pro games ever played. And part of it was the last game of the year. Every batter was just out there swinging at anything because everybody was in a hurry to go home. So that's the story of Kit. Kit went on to become a very well-known teacher in West Vancouver, social studies teacher, and then he was head of the BC Teachers Federation, and then did many other admirable things after that. Bob's a cartoonist, so he's done nothing admirable.
again, it's just a great story about you know, two local boys. Who, you know, I guess this is their summer job, if you will.
Yeah.
And you know, the you know, they get a lifetime of memories. I could talk all morning with you, and this book is just full of those wonderful stories. Congratulations on this book, and continue good luck with it. So appreciate your time today, Tom.
Oh, thank you so much, Joseph. I really enjoyed talking to you. You are somebody who loves books, takes the time to ask writers why and how and what they've done. It is very much appreciated by, I think, everybody in the writing community.
Well, thanks very much, and hopefully you make it out to the Nat this summer.
I hope, maybe even, I'm not going to make it this month, but I hope to be there in June.
There you go. And I should mention for people listening to this, at the moment, the BC Sports Hall of Fame is a place to order the book. And you can go there in person, like I'll be doing this week, and buying the book there, as well as the Nat Bailey Stadium will have copies for sale too, right?
That's right. The book is shrink-wrapped, so it won't get damaged while you're spilling hot dog mustard and beer on it, or you can pick it up on the way out the door. It is a hefty, beautiful coffee table book.
Thanks for this, Tom.
Thank you, Joseph.
The book is called Play Ball, The Amazing Stories and Captivating Characters Who Have Made Baseball a Winning Ticket in Vancouver for Over 100 Years. It's author Tom Hawthorne. Join me on the line from Victoria in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.